The third case for argument is Hannah Heckel versus Hunter Warfield, Inc.
Good morning, Mr. Schwiebert. We'll hear from you first.
Darren Breyer Schwiebert for the appellant Hannah Heckel. For the 6% interest 1692 F1 claim before this court, the court only has to decide one question. Has the Minnesota Supreme Court decided which interest statute is controlling in this case? The answer is yes. The case is Poehler versus Cincinnati Insurance Company from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2017. And this is what the Minnesota Supreme Court held. Accordingly, we hold that Min Stat 54909, Subdivision 1B, unambiguously provides for pre-award interest on all awards of pecuniary damages that are not specifically excluded by the statute and does not restrict the recovery of pre-award interest to cases or matters involving wrong duty or breach of contract.
But that last point, I was on that case. I ended up joining the dissent, as I recall. But I do remember that case. And I think that last part of it, wrongful behavior, is actually what that case was about. I mean, the dissent talks about it. The majority talks about it. There were no other statutes at play that I can remember in that case.
I understand what the issue is before the court in Poehler. But the court in Poehler, like lots of Supreme Court decisions, look at a particular fact pattern and then establish a law so that every single case that comes back, it doesn't have to decide based on the individual facts. They're unambiguously holding 54909 is the interest statute unless it falls within that exception. I generally believe reading a block quote to a court of appeals is a waste of precious limited time. But that quote really is the Supreme Court of Minnesota answering the
But there's question. Also a long time, and I know Minnesota adopts this, it's in the federal courts as well, which is if it doesn't take positions on things that are not before the court. And so I don't think it was talking about other interests. Look, I didn't join it, so I mean, but my understanding of it is that's what the court was trying to say. And the language was very imprecise. It was sloppy, no question about that. But I don't know that it establishes the broad proposition that you suggest.
The subsequent Minnesota Court of Appeals decision in K&L addressing the divide between 549 and, understand, now we've gone back down to the Court of Appeals, 549 and 33401 says the reason why 33401 does not have to be referenced in the decision is because the court is making the broad proclamation. That is the broad proclamation that ends the debate at the state court level.
Do you know whether the briefs raised 33401 in Poehler?
I have not looked at the briefs in Poehler since 2017, so okay. I would not want to make a representation that's inaccurate to this court.
I didn't recall it, but go ahead.
I don't remember it, but I can't answer definitively either way for the court. Three things are worth noting about the Poehler decision. First, this appeal involves an alleged breach of contract, a lease agreement, which is the language that appears at the end of that quote from Poehler about 54909 applying to more than just a breach of contract case. Certainly it would apply to this case. Second, there was no argument in the district court, in the district court's opinion, or on appeal to this court that the claim in this appeal is within one of the five exceptions of 54909. That argument's been waived. That will become extremely important when we get to Hill and Klein, because There is no exception, which leaves you only with the broad rule that 549.09 ambiguously controls. Third, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruling is binding on this court. That's the commissioner versus the state of Bosch. Hunter Warfield actually admits this in page 19 of their brief. Hunter Warfield relies on this court's decisions in Hill and Klein to try and escape the Polar decision. There are three problems with their argument. First, both Hill and Klein were 549.09 exception cases. Keep in mind, Polar holds that unless you fall within the exception, 549.09 applies. Both Hill and Klein were conciliation court cases. Therefore, they fell into the exception. The appellant in both Hill and Klein, represented by me, argued that 549.09 should not apply and that the interest rate should therefore be zero. This court disagreed. But that's not the question here. In fact, it's the opposite of the question here. The question in this case is, does 549.09 apply, the 4% interest rate, as opposed to the 6% they sent in their letter? This is not an exception case. 549.09 applies as Polar held. Second, in both Hill and Klein, the collection activity predated the Polar decision. Note, neither Hill nor Klein reference Polar specifically. But this is the reason why Polar is not referenced, in my opinion, in either of those cases. As this court explained in Smith v. SCJ, the interest rate was at the time legally uncertain. What that means is when Hill sent its collection activity in 2015 and Klein did their collection activity in March of 2017, Polar had not yet come out. And what's going on in Hill and Klein is the court recognizing that the Polar decision, which in my opinion clarifies the law 100% for Minnesota law, had not yet done that. And therefore, their activity in this appeal, the letter, January 11th of 2022, is 4.5 years after Polar. Keep in mind the same language about legally uncertain at the time appears in the footnote in Bassett. Third, Minnesota Supreme Court decisions on Minnesota law are controlling on this court even as to previous decisions of this court. That's the World Harvest Church case. It's like...
Say that again?
It's the... If this court has existing cases and the Minnesota Supreme Court rules in a different way, because these are questions of state law.
If it comes later, that's true. But if our court comes after Polar and says, we think the Minnesota Supreme Court has not decided the issue, then our court has decided that Polar hasn't decided the issue.
In Hill and Klein, the reason why the court said it hadn't decided the issue was because it was an exception case. The appellant in those cases was arguing, because it's an exception, 549.09 goes away and there is nothing left. And instead, this court said, no, if you're within the exception, you can go back to 334.01. This case is different because there is no exception. But the question of this court's Hill and Klein is like the difference between predicting that the 49ers are going to win the Super Bowl and knowing that the Kansas City Chiefs actually won the Super Bowl. This court is trying to predict what Minnesota law will be, but once the Polar decision comes out and is controlling because it postdates the collection activity, predates the collection activity, Polar's answered the question. This court is bound by the Polar decision. There's no dispute on appeal. Hunter Warfield abandons the remaining arguments by the district court. Unintentional dicta, same judicial author, improper construction of 1692 F1. Those are all addressed in our opening brief. Heckle has standing for her 1692 F1 claim. There's one throwaway line where they claim she doesn't have standing. Collection of money not permitted by contract or law is financial injury. There are only two 1692 F1 standing cases from this court, DeMurray and Bassett. This case is similar to DeMurray. The plaintiff pled in this case, similar to the allegations in DeMurray, that the conduct by the defendant caused out-of-pocket costs, worry and sleeplessness, as well as cost her time and money. That's
what about the fact that we're at a summary judgment stage now? Did you put in any evidence of those alleged injuries?
That's an interesting question because the issue wasn't raised in the district court.
Right,
but what it
my question is whether you put on any evidence of it, whether it was...
No, because it wasn't the issue. The only issue is our motion for summary judgment that Poehler says what the interest rate should be. If
in order to support your motion, don't you have to demonstrate that you have standing?
Because they had answered and there was no dispute about it, no, we didn't have to put on any evidence. We had our...
Doesn't the court have to resolve that, whether the side raises it or not?
If it was raised by the court or addressed by the court could address whether or not it happened, which is why if this court is concerned about the standing for the other claims, I think remand is the right answer because it's going to get remanded back down for a summary judgment motion, not a motion to dismiss. They already answered. They passed that stage in the litigation. It's one of those cases where it makes sense for this court on the non-interest to send it back down, if that's what the court's inclined to do, to have the district court take the evidentiary record of those additional harms. But as a pure pleading question, I think the complaint pleads enough for those allegations. The fact that we moved for summary judgment didn't put a burden on us to prove something that wasn't in dispute before the court. It wasn't raised by them or by the court at that stage.
Well, you keep saying that it wasn't raised, but standing doesn't have to be raised.
But it was sufficiently pled. The answer by the appellee is that it has to be more particularized than we pled. That's not Eighth Circuit law. There's a couple of cases out of Missouri that address that. We specifically pled, like in DeMurray, which is the other F1 case, that there was a loss of both financial and a physical harms, the sleeplessness and the loss.
What if we hold that those are too conclusory, that you need to at least plead specific facts beyond that? Here's what I lost, $4,000, whatever it is.
There's no Eighth Circuit case that says that's required. If that had been the argument below, we could have amended and made those additional allegations. It was simply never addressed. The other two causes of action get swept up by the district court and sent up to the Court of Appeals without ever being addressed. Now they argue standing and Rooker-Feldman on appeal, but those issues were not addressed by the court down below. In addition to the physical and financial harm, it is harm similar to other causes of action. The G claim is similar to a negligence claim, a duty that's breached. The E claims are similar to fraudulent misrepresentation and infliction of emotional distress. Rooker-Feldman, I'll simply say, in light of this case, Hageman decision, post-Exxon, and the fact we're not seeking relief from a judicial opinion, particularly one that's not monetary, Rooker-Feldman does not apply.
I just want to ask one quick follow-up before you sit down, which is the emotional harms. We have a case, a Ajoglu versus Rodenberg law firm, that says nervousness, restlessness, irritability, amongst other negative motions, fall short of cognizable injury. So I understand your argument about the out-of-pocket costs, and we'll have to deal with that. But do you agree under our case law that that doesn't provide standing?
I'd have to look at the Ojigu case again, and I'll talk about it when I get back up. I have it with me. But the financial would be sufficient, as it was right in DeMurray, even because it is either or for establishing the concrete injury. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your argument. Mr. Grassi, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, David Grassi on behalf of defendant and appellee Hunter Warfield, Inc. Before I get into my argument, I would like to address Your Honor's question. I did look at the briefs in Poehler in both the Supreme Court and the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and none of them addressed 334.01. The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act was enacted in 1978 in part to prevent abusive debt collection practices. At the time it was enacted, the harms associated with such practices were readily apparent and easily satisfied Article III standing requirements. That is no longer the case. To paraphrase the Honorable Brian Kogan of the Eastern District of New York, claims brought under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act are now being litigated at the hyper-technical margins of permissible collection activity. That, as a result of that, we now have an uncoupling of the standing and with the violation whereby plaintiffs bringing claims have to allege both the violation and that there's a sufficient concrete injury traceable to the violation. And the history of that, you can go back to the 1992 Supreme Court case in Lujan where they talked about the standing requirements, then 15 or so years later to Iqbal and Twombly where they talked about pleading requirements, to 2016 Spokio versus Robbins, which started the ball rolling in both the district and circuit court level for these standing attacks, and more recently in the 2021 case of TransUnion versus Ramirez. And that really accelerated these analyses. Your Honor mentioned the Ajagu case, and we think that is squarely on point. Here, the plaintiff alleges certain negative emotions, but the Eighth Circuit was clear in Ajagu that that is not enough. And in ruling, it cited to, with approval and quoted, the Pinnell case from the Seventh Circuit for the proposition that for emotional distress, there needs to be a physical manifestation and a qualified medical diagnosis. That was not alleged here. And while not specifically addressed by the court, I would note that if you look at the Ajagu complaint, Mr. Ajagu does allege out-of-pocket expenses and does so in a verified complaint with, I think, about 40 pages of exhibits.
To be fair, though, I mean, we are bound by that case, but there's a pretty square circuit split on emotional injuries and whether it requires to manifest itself. And I think we're on the short end of the circuit split, but that makes it no less binding. And so I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Even still, a plaintiff has to allege a concrete harm traceable to the alleged violation. Here, Ms. Heckel alleges conclusory boilerplate harm language that, you know, sleep and worry. And as the court noted in Ajagu, that those are the types of emotions one would associate with owing a debt and being in collections generally. It's not specifically traceable to the violation that they allege occurred in the letter.
So what exactly are you proposing the court do with this case, given your arguments about standing?
That the court find a lack of standing and remand for dismissal without prejudice.
On all the claims, including the one that Judge Magnuson decided?
Yes, Your Honor, because we believe the standing issue applies across the board.
Okay. That's what I thought you were suggesting. We wouldn't reach the merits if we accepted that view. We would just remand.
Correct, Your Honor.
Without prejudice.
Correct. I don't believe the court can reach the merits.
What about the argument from the other side that we should analyze the standing based on the pleadings at this point? Because they didn't have notice, I guess is his argument that they had to put on evidence.
While we believe the court is entitled to look at the full record, we also believe they have not pled enough to bring this claim. So we believe the pleadings fail in the allegations.
Even the monetary claim on the pleadings?
Yes, Your Honor, because that is a generalized claim unsupported by specific facts. That would not satisfy the Iqbal Twombly standard. And I would note in our brief we cited an Ebaugh case from the Eastern District of Missouri and 28J citation to Gumpel case out of the Eastern District of Missouri, both said for the proposition that vague claims of costs and money are not enough. You have to relate them, explain what they are, and relate them to the violation. Mm-hmm. And in that way, it's distinguishable from the DeMurray case that Ms. Heckel relies on. In that case, that involved a consumer suing a debt buyer and a law firm. The law firm brought suit on behalf of the debt buyer, never intending to take the case to trial. They did not seek default judgment, instead were hoping to get a judgment based on non-appearance at trial. They showed up. Mr. DeMarais showed up with counsel. The debt buyer was not ready to proceed, had no evidence to present, so sought a continuance. The next setting, again, Mr. DeMarais showed up with counsel. The debt buyer did not have any witnesses or any evidence to present and dismissed the case with prejudice and subsequently served discovery in that case, which is a bit of an odd twist. But nevertheless, that Mr. DeMarais was forced to take action based on these alleged violations in order to preserve his rights. That has not happened here. Ms. Heckel does not allege that she took any specific action as a result of receiving this letter, nor does she allege she elected not to take any action. In DeMarais, there was a specific action taken, and a penalty would have accrued if that action was not taken. Here, there's no action, and there's no penalty.
I know you're trying to distinguish DeMarais, but the other problem with DeMarais, at least as precedent, potentially, is it preceded TransUnion, which obviously sort of clarified what's needed in a case like this one.
Yes, Your Honor, and also Ajagwu and Bassett. And I would note that the Bassett case, this court decided there was no jurisdiction after a trial by jury, and that case dealt with a letter that included attempt to seek an interest rate that was absolutely not allowed by law. And I would note, Mr. Schwiebert said, the collection of money is standing, but there's no collection here. So you don't have the common law analogs that the Supreme Court has instructed courts to look at. So if we're looking at fraud for either a misrepresentation or an omission of a material fact, you would need not just reliance, but detrimental reliance. Ms. Heckel does not even allege reliance, let alone detrimental reliance. For emotional distress, I believe that's covered by the Ajagwu case, but it says physical manifestation and qualified medical diagnosis, which again is not alleged.
Can I ask you about the economic injury? And in particular, this is something that troubles me about the case. And maybe the answer is it's the wrong defendant they're suing for purposes of this injury, which is she clearly has a debt. She clearly wants the debt to be smaller, hence the interest rate claim. She hasn't paid the debt, is my understanding. But it sounds to me like that would be an injury in a case against the landlord, right? Because I want to pay less. Why isn't it an injury against the debt collector?
Well, so I would note that the landlord is not covered under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, so that would be a Minnesota state claim brought in a Minnesota state court. But for here, there's no injury for the simple fact that there's no harm tied to the alleged violation or traceable to the alleged violation. She basically says she got a collection letter, vague allegations of time and cost, doesn't say what they were, and doesn't say why they were caused by the alleged violation, any of the alleged violations.
So wrong defendant, wrong act. I mean, this is not what caused her to have to pay more is essentially a response, I think, if I'm reading you correctly.
Yes, and she didn't pay more. She didn't pay anything.
Right.
And our federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, whereas, you know, a claim against a landlord in a state courts are, for the most part, courts of general jurisdiction. So there may be avenue there where she could push that issue with the landlord. This is just not the avenue for that. In Ms. Heckel's reply, she mentioned some other potential common law analogs. We believe those are distinguishable. She mentioned intrusion upon seclusion, but that would require highly offensive intrusion, and there's nothing highly offensive about a single collection letter. And I would note that the EBAW court was not prepared to say that receipt of a single letter could not qualify, but you needed more in the allegations to get there. Ms. Heckel also points to conversion or civil theft, but those require the wrongful taking or retention of money or property, which again did not happen here. There was no payment made. She points to abusive process or wrongful civil proceedings, but there were no filings like there were in DeMaray. There was simply a collection letter. And also note, while this case has been appealed, in our 28J citation, we reference a District of Minnesota case, decision that came down in March, Delgado versus Midland Credit Management. They looked at that issue. In that case, there was a misrepresentation, I believe it was a misrepresentation in a summons, and the court said that was not enough for standing on that issue because the misrepresentation was for a portion of the claim. It did not go to the decision to bring the lawsuit. But again, I don't even think we have to get that far here because there was no lawsuit. There was not even a threat of a lawsuit. And counsel also mentioned a negligence claim. But even if there is a statutory duty, there is no allegation of injury traceable to the failure to receive the information. And I think a Seventh Circuit case that was not mentioned in the briefing but is instructive is Casillas versus Madison Avenue Associates. That was from 2019, 1926 F3rd 329. That was an opinion authored by now Justice Barrett. And in that case, the consumer alleged a defective G notice. And in determining the consumer did not have standing, the court noted that the consumer did not allege they would have taken action if they had received a defective G notice or that the defective G notice prevented them from taking action. And that's what we have here. Ms. Heckel does not allege if this notice did contain the 1692G notice that she would have disputed. She does not allege she took any action, does not allege she refrained from taking any action. Therefore, she cannot meet the traceability elements, even if her allegations were more than conclusory. I know there was some discussion about whether it would be appropriate to remand. I don't think this court needs to do that. One, because this decision on standing is a decision this court is obligated to look at and make on its own. Two, because we're saying the pleadings are inadequate, it would be a de novo review anyway. The case cited in the reply brief was an instance where the record was incomplete. Here, we're not saying we're saying that the pleadings are insufficient, so there's no need to make a record to support it, and that she's not entitled to make a record to support it.
Why not raise it below to the district court? I know you're raising it now. Why not raise it to Judge Magnuson?
I don't have a good answer, Your Honor. I was not involved in the case at that point. Briefly, I'd like to turn to the interest issue. If the court does determine there is standing, we believe the court should affirm the ruling of the district court on the interest issue. The Polar case was a decision about whether 549.09 applied to those circumstances and whether and how it was applied. It was not, did not in any way address the interplay between that and 334.01. In effect, Ms. Heckel is asking that the court consider the Minnesota Supreme Court decision Polar to do what she says the district court couldn't do here, which was rule on issue that was not before it. And simply put, 334.01 was never raised in that case, and that involved a real estate appraisal. Appraisal, by its nature, is somebody's best guess, is an estimate. It is not readily ascertainable damages. Here we have readily ascertainable amounts. We've got a lease agreement and utilities that are calculable based on objective measures. Therefore, it's appropriate to 334.01. I would note in our 28J citation that the Minnesota Court of Appeals did that in March. A petition has been filed with the Minnesota Supreme Court, but in Liu versus Sabri, Minnesota Court of Appeals recently just applied 334.01 to prejudgment damages in a breach of contract case. Thank you.
Did you send us a citation on that last case?
I did, Your Honor. I filed a 28J letter, and then I supplemented that to update to note there was an appeal in one of the cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwiebert.
Resolving Liu first, it's a unpublished case which is not precedential under Minnesota law. As to the financial harms, I don't think there's any dispute that financial harms have been pled and they are sufficient to grant standing. As to the physical harms, the emotional distress, I think there is a divide between the circuits. And I think that Jagu is an interesting case because the court makes a big deal about the fact that the harm that he's alleging is a result of not paying the debt, not a result of the letter that he receives and just hands off to the lawyer. So I think it's a factually different case. In this case, the harms are not alleged from the debt. The harms are alleged from the conduct of the defendants. I don't think it's the wrong party for the financial harm because they're attempting to collect the amount, and they are overstating it.
What was the financial harm? She didn't pay. She didn't allege that she paid anything.
No, but I don't think she has to get a financial harm.
What's the financial harm?
Her out-of-pocket costs, the amount of her debt being higher is itself a financial harm. They're alleging that she owes more money than she really does is a financial harm. That's the reason why F1 exists, so that you can't claim money that's not owed by contract or law. They're harming her by doing that. Other circuits have looked at the F1 and said all F1 cases have standing. This circuit went a different way in Bassett. But again, I think Bassett has very specific facts. They said it was just the letter. They didn't have the pleading benefits that this case and DeMurray case. As to the analogous state court claims, of course, an element of each one of those is missing, or we would have pled those state court claims. But that doesn't mean that the harm they seek to redress is not the harm at issue in this case. This case really, evidently now, comes down to this question of particularization. Under Iqbal, you're trying not to plead formulaic elements. We didn't say we suffered financial or physical harm, which would be the formulaic. Instead, the complaint lists the specific physical and emotional. They say we have to plead more than that. I don't think that's true, particularly in light of this court's decision in DeMurray. I think alleging the specific financial harm is sufficient. The complaint in DeMurray had no more specificity. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted, and the court will file a decision in due course.